Hey guys, welcome to episode 214 of the podcast with my guest, Annie Leonard. I wanted to thank Amir Talai, a past guest of my podcast and a dear friend, for introducing Annie and me. I am excited to share with you guys things that inspire Annie and kind of what her teenage years were like and how they impacted her ability and confidence to make waves in the world and to feel like she could be impactful, because I know that's something that we all kind of struggle with sometimes. And I want to thank Christine for her email, and I will get caught up with more soon, but I want to say anybody who's around in the Southern California area this weekend, Stan Against Evil is going to be having a kind of a sneak peek panel and Q&A with John C. McGinley and me and creator and co-star Dana Gould at Monsterpalooza on Saturday. So check that out. I tweeted about it, and I'm sure there's other stuff I'm forgetting that I want to let you know about, but it wouldn't be an intro if I didn't feel like I was forgetting something. So hope you guys enjoyed the episode, and I will talk to you soon. Thanks.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
The requisite, how's the weather in the Bay Area? Just because I don't feel like I ask that with every guest that I podcast remotely, but because it's sort of my favorite place in the world in many ways, it's always nice to kind of do a little check-in and find out how everything's going up there.
You know, everything is always going great here. It is beautiful and sunny and not too hot and not too cold. And I just checked, my tomato plants out back are just so abundant, you know, it's great.
Oh, now you're really rubbing it in.
I know. I don't usually tell people that because it's hard not to gloat if you live in the Bay Area. But, you know, you guys can all gloat back when we have our next big earthquake.
Yeah, well, I'm in L.A., so who knows what's going to happen down here. I feel like you can use the earthquake thing when people in Texas are angry. But in L.A., I sort of have that risk as much as I have anything else, but I don't have the weather. Where are you from originally? Oh, that's okay. Annie, did you grow tomato plants when you were a teenager? Where were you when you were a teen?
I grew up in Seattle, which is such an awesome place to grow up.
Yes, it is. Now, again, we're sort of diving around on the West Coast here, talking about some of the best places on Earth, in my opinion. That's a very American solipsistic point of view to have, but at least within the United States, I love Seattle. I love Portland.
Me too. But, you know, I grew up in Seattle, and then I lived in a lot of other places before I came back, you know, basically home. Berkeley is very Seattle-like. I left Seattle to go to New York City, and then upstate New York for college and graduate school. Then I lived in Washington, D.C. for a decade. And then I lived in Bangladesh and India for three years. Then back to D.C., and then I finally said, it's time to go home. And so I came back to the West Coast.
That is a very impressive CV of places that you've lived. And talk about, too, like such different vibes in some of those places. Obviously, the sort of central focal point of the kind of energy of the city, at least the way people think of it from the outside, I guess, kind of wildly different. I mean, D.C. and Berkeley, that's got to be a pretty
really
different.
Different. I really noticed it when I'm at a dinner party and I ask everybody around the table, what do you do? And, you know, I think, wow, this is a different universe than Washington, D.C.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, it's great. But they say the best way to learn about your home is to go somewhere else. And so I find that, you know, the more I travel, the more I understand what about home makes me so happy.
Absolutely. That reminds me of, I don't know if I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I love Barbara Kingsolver, and I don't know if you're familiar with her writing, but she wrote a gorgeous, she's a great fiction writer, and she also, she's very, very interested in sort of biology, sciences, the animal world, flora and fauna, and she settled in Tucson, which is where I was born and raised, even though she's from the Appalachian Mountains, and she wrote a beautiful book of essays called High Tide in Tucson, around one of the Bush's elections. I mean, we're talking, you know, sort of post Gulf War, I think. And her opening essay is basically, you know, I had some sort of a bumper sticker that was in support of, you know, some, I don't even want to say fringe organization, but just something that was, you know, Nader-esque or, you know, Al Gore kind of Inconvenient Truth type acknowledgement, I think, on her car. And she was sort of almost run down by, I'm sorry to say, when cliches prove real, because that's always, it doesn't help to perpetuate stereotypes, but some guy in like a big pickup truck just sort of screamed at her, you know, America, love it or leave it. And she says, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but she says she sort of had this moment where she kind of heard that expression in a new way for the first time. And that she had this kind of epiphany and was like, you know what? I think I need to leave it for a while. And she moved to Europe and lived there for a year and just had the same, you know, very much that sort of experience of, I really had to get away from it to get a perspective on what was frustrating to me, what made me angry about it, what I wanted to change, but also to, you know, kind of reinvigorate my love of what makes it so special. And I think that's...
I can totally relate. Yeah. Every time I go to a new place, I think of new things I love here. But when I hear that sentence, love it or leave it, which I hear often when I'm out doing environmental work, I think of, I'll choose to love it. And the way I choose to love it is to try to make it better.
Absolutely.
It seems to me the people that, you know, put their fingers in their ears and don't want to talk about growing inequality or childhood obesity or crummy public schools or pesticides or, you know, all these other things, the people who don't want to acknowledge it, that's not how you love a country. You love a country by working through the list of problems and solving one and then going to the next.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, isn't that kind of what we're talking about here, is that oversimplification of, that's an easy thing to throw at someone, but there's nothing behind it. It's this flimsy tissue paper, you know, accusation, this sort of thing you can throw out there. That just doesn't hold any water at all. You can't back it up with anything because of exactly what you just said, this sort of idea of like, well, wait a minute. If that, then does that apply to this? Does that apply to this? Does that apply to this? If I love my body and my health, but I'm diagnosed with cancer, is it a love it or leave it situation? Like, what does that even mean? You know what I'm saying?
That's a great one. I often think about it as a parent. You know, if I had a kid who was doing drugs and littering and, you know, had all of these problems, I wouldn't say, that's all right, honey, I love you.
Right.
I would say, come on, let's shape up.
Exactly.
I'd say, I love you and shape up.
Exactly. And so was Seattle for you, you know, obviously that is a community, I think of it at least, as, you know, certainly not one, just one community, but a series of communities and a city that does have this kind of finger on the pulse of certain global awarenesses, environmental awarenesses that, you know, for better or for worse, you may not find in, you know, a city of industry in middle America. Was that, in terms of what you ended up pursuing and the voice that you end up being in our nation, did you feel like that was something that you really kind of got to know through the city of Seattle? Or was that something that was very independent and individual to you?
I definitely think it's partly, largely from growing up there. And, you know, when you grow up someplace, whatever you're around, you get so acclimated to it, you don't realize it's an optional thing, that somebody else might have a different set of priorities. So the two big things about Seattle that impacted me were clearly the proximity to and commitment to the environment. People ride bikes and hike, and the city is so green, and there's water everywhere. And on a clear day when you can see the snow-capped Olympics on one side and the snow-capped Cascades on the other side, it's just like, how can you have any other feeling other than just humility and awe? So the environment was a big piece, but also, you know, it's a big international port city with just a lot of people coming and going. And I grew up right by the university. There were just people from lots of different countries, lots of different kinds of food, just a real international outlook. I think from being such a port city, that also just sort of piqued my curiosity about the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know there was any other way than to care about the environment and be interested in the world.
Well, that's always interesting to me. I mean, I think I podcast someone, and I'm sure the listeners remember better than I can at the moment, but someone, I don't know if it was Zelda Williams or Colin Hanks, somebody who grew up, I think, in the Bay Area, said, you know, I lived this sort of cloistered, liberal life where I quite honestly didn't know that I knew any Republicans, and remember it being this sort of event moment when I finally met somebody who had, you know, very different, very vocal views, who was just standing next to me in a room, rather than it being this kind of thing that got discussed on television or by, you know, by my parents complaining about people that I didn't know and, you know, kind of couldn't really put into a context of like, oh, this is a flesh and blood person that I'm just talking to. And that's so funny about these sort of bubbles, because I think we hear a lot about the other side, the kind of the bubble of, well, this person hasn't interacted much with any other types of, you know, races or cultures, or this is the way their parents, you know, raise them. And it's this kind of thing that there's like a pattern that has to be broken. And so I'm always kind of, I mean, tickled is sort of a, I don't mean that in a condescending way, but I'm always really interested when people are like, no, listen, I didn't, like, this was, these voices were very loud and they were my reality. And I wasn't dealing with a lot of, you know, because like, for example, with Arizona, that's a very divided state, you know, it's certainly ends up voting red, but there are so many very liberal people in it. And so there's, that was a day-to-day thing for me, was this sort of like very open argument happening at any given time in that state. You know what I mean? But I think there are parts of, I guess there are parts of Washington that are very conservative too, as you kind of move east. Is that true?
Yeah, but you have to go over the mountains to get to them. So it was easy to not cross paths. But you know, that's another reason why it's so important to travel, so that we do challenge our assumptions, so that we hold our assumptions because we believe them to be true and have thought about them, not just because we were told. And I realize not everyone has the privilege to move to Bangladesh like I did. But, you know, you can just cross town or go to the local library or often just cross the street to find people with different perspectives. It's so important we force ourselves to do that and challenge our thinking.
Absolutely. Well, what was the high school that you went to like? Was there a lot of diversity there, if not politically, then in terms of sort of every other bag, mixed bag you can imagine in a high school? Or was it a private school, public?
There was not a lot of diversity. And, it, you know, it was really, this is for sure another formative part of my life. I went to Lakeside, which is an incredibly elite private school in Seattle. It has since become much more socially focused on social justice and much more racially diverse. But just to give you a sense of what it was like, it's the school where Bill Gates went. We were constantly told we were the cream of the crop, the smartest kids, which I don't think is a healthy thing to be told. It was interesting for me to be there because I was absolutely the scholarship kid. My mom was the first kid in her family to go to college. I was raised by a single mom who was a school nurse. And so I was plopped down in perhaps one of my earliest cross-cultural experiences in a school where people got Volvos when they turned 16 and were all members of the tennis club.
Yeah.
So it was fascinating for me to be exposed to this kind of wealth. And even though it wasn't always comfortable and I often felt awkward because I didn't have the right shoes or the Varney sunglasses or whatever, it actually was good for me because it took away the veneer of thinking wealth provides happiness, because I saw a lot of rich, a lot of unhappy kids. And so it was good get that out of my system early.
No kidding. Do you come from a large family?
My one mom and three kids and two dogs and four cats and various reptiles.
Did your siblings also go to that school, or were you a standout in that way?
My sister went there and my brother went there for a while and then switched to a slightly mellower private school. I told you my mom was the first kid in her family to graduate from college. And she said she just thought education was salvation. She said she'd spend her last dollar on education. And I really appreciate the value that she instilled in me around education, but also that she said, just get educated and I don't care what you do. So when I got all my degrees and then said, I'm going to go be a radical environmentalist, she said, go, honey, go. She never said, no, be a lawyer or a doctor. It's just about getting the education. So the doors are there for you.
And what, you know, as you're talking about the experience of kind of being the quote unquote other in the school, how did that contribute, or did it contribute to also this sense of, and I'm, by the way, I'm the worst at forming questions ever because I'm basically asking 25 questions and I'm trying to cram it into one question. But I guess what I'm interested in is this, you know, for those guests I have that have really made huge strides in some way in public life, in, you know, taking a stand, and feeling empowered to do that. When I was a teenager, I just didn't, you know, for some people that the youth is all about the sort of the sky's the limit, and it's before maybe you, you know, start to feel like you're tethered to the ground on some level. Although, you know, puberty and acne can certainly help burst that bubble. But, but you know, I was just so meek, and I was not an unconfident teenager, but I don't feel like I felt like I had the power to be the agent of change, you know, as a young person. Is that something that you connected with early, or is it something that developed along the way?
I definitely did not have that sense of agency early on.
Why am I relieved? It's too late for me to relive it anyway, but I'm like, oh, good, that's really a relief. Thanks, Annie.
Don't you wish you could go back and redo it now with the sense of agency?
Just be
you have
fierce
as
hell, yeah.
The one thing I do think I got out of, I mean, many things I got out of the school, and it was a really incredible school academically, and I'm very grateful that for the scholarship and financial aid they gave me. But I'll tell you, it made me comfortable with being an outsider, because there was no way I was going to get a Volvo and be a part of the tennis club and all these things. It just wasn't an option. So I could either have been just totally dwarfed by insecurity, or I could just say, hey, I'm different and that's cool, and embrace that. And being able to be comfortable with being an outsider just opens a lot more possibilities in life. So I'm grateful to have.
And what was that process like for you? I mean, how were you treated by your fellow students, and what was that process like of sort of going, you know what, I'm going to get comfortable with this, because I can't imagine that it felt great initially.
Well, you know, a lot of the not feeling great part was associated with materialism. And I mean, I don't know how old you are, but in my day, everyone had to have these stupid Varney sunglasses and Calvin Klein jeans. And there was so much focus on specific items that were hardship for our family to get. And so I have to choose hardship or making peace with what I have. And making peace with what you have is just a way better life than the hardship of always trying to keep up. Yeah. So one part of it was that. But, you know, actually, you know, we were talking earlier about how traveling opened your perspective. I went to this school from 5th grade to 12th grade. It was a very small, very homogenous school. I think there were two kids of color in our class that were always on the front page of the annual report, of course. Uh-huh. It gets much different now. But it was so small and so homogenous, and I was so antsy to see the world that I decided to do something totally different my junior year of high school, to pick the most different school I could find. So I was at a co-ed day school in Seattle. I got a book, because this was before the internet, and looked up, and I found a all-girls boarding school right outside New York City, and applied, and my mom was sort of chuckling at my little project, and got in, and got scholarship, and mom was like, wait a minute, you were serious about this? And I went and spent my junior year at this all-girls boarding school in New York City, where there was a different set of material items that people.
I was
going to
say,
over.
As a public school child whose parents were both teachers, that still to me is like, oh my, that seems extremely intimidating still.
Yeah, I know. I don't know what I was thinking, but you know, I just wanted to try something different, so I did. But when I saw, oh, these people obsess over a different kind of sunglasses instead of Varney's, it took the glitz of Varney's point. I'm like, oh, we can choose what we obsess over. It is not ordained by gravity or the gods or something. We can pick what we are concerned about. So that was very liberating.
Absolutely. Were you like a secondhand kid? Were you a thrift store shopper? Were you a hand-me-downs from your sister?
Oh, heavens, not from my sister, but from the thrift stores for certain. But, you know, it was kind of cool back then when you had more time than money to go dig through the thrift shops and find cool stuff and sew patches on it and all that.
Is that another kind of, I mean, Yeah, because even in Seattle, it's not going to be just a city of people who are all kind of holding hands, singing Kumbaya, and putting, you know, bottles into a recycling bin in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Were there people around that weren't a part of your school that you kind of looked to, friendships that you had outside of that were meaningful and kind of grounded you when you know, everybody else was sort of looking at their sunglasses and patting themselves on the back?
Absolutely. You know, I lived in a neighborhood where people didn't move. So there were lots of kids in the neighborhood that I knew from birth until now because people just didn't move. My mom was involved in the Unitarian Church, which is a really great community. Mm-hmm. You know, we are not really religious. That was the place where I went to hear El Salvadorian refugees talk about the war there or register as a conscientious objector when I was 12. And, you know, it was a really socially oriented kind of a church. And we were right next to the university. And, you know, anytime around a big university, that's just a lot of different kind of people coming by, events, lectures. You know, really, really anywhere you are, if you're interested in finding good people, there's good people.
Mm-hmm. When you say that it wasn't a particularly religious organization, that was something that, you know, these guys know, I grew up with an atheist dad and a, you know, my parents were separated and then subsequently divorced. And I'm an only child. My mom raised me basically on Sundays because she had custody of me on Sundays and I had to go to Mormon church with her. And I had a couple of friends who were Universalist. Yeah. And I just looked on it with such envy, because there was so much about the stuff that I was being told that didn't really work for me. But then I also had this atheistic dad who is extremely social and sociable, and I think, you know, probably would consider himself a secular humanist. But for me, that there was almost like, with my Universalist friends, I almost felt like they were secular humanists. Like, they weren't really talking about God using the words I was familiar with from you know, having to go to church with my mom. So when you say it wasn't particularly religious, what does the service look like for you as a teenager at a Universalist church in Seattle?
Well, I'll tell you, one time when I was very young, I asked the Sunday school teacher there, I said, do we believe in God or not? Like, I couldn't figure out what was happening because it just seemed fun. You know, and when people in school would talk about, do they believe in God or not? I'm like, I'm not sure.
Right.
And so I asked the Sunday school teacher, and she said, we don't know if there's a God or not, but we think it's more important to just focus on making life better for everybody here now. And I was like,
wow.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And I thought that was great. And so I think there's probably some people there who believe in God, some people that don't. But instead of fighting about that, let's put the energy into making the world a better place.
Absolutely. Well, that's one thing that I think I always kind of, you know, my dad has a wonderful community of friends, many of whom are friends with one another. And I'm sure he would, you know, certainly say that there's nothing lacking in his life. And because he converted and went to church with my mom early in their marriage before it became clear that that was a ginormous commitment that he probably never should have made. You know, I think he did kind of get a kick out of, like, you know, playing on their basketball teams and, you know, going on field trips with my mom and then me as a tiny baby before they split up. And I think that is the kind of the permission to be in a community organization like that, that does create this sense of, you know, companionship on a group scale, without being too terribly didactic, is something that I think I would have liked. I mean, I think I liked what was community, focused about being at church, but I wasn't interested in, you know, feeling like people outside of that were like really missing out or in deep trouble or something.
Right. If we could have the community part and the make the world better part and the love and kindness part without the judgment and scorn and wrath of hell part, then that'd
yeah.
be
yeah.
just
and
right.
I mean, there and from what you say, it sounds like I think that we're I want to believe we're headed more towards that than not, as a species. But what do you think about that?
Oh, I think we absolutely are. I think we had a turn in the wrong way for a number of decades. And I think people got lonely. I mean, if you look at the data, a lot of group activity has declined over the previous 4 to 5 decades. We're working longer hours than we have before, spending more time commuting, more time alone looking at screens. And the kind of things that are going away to make the space for all that is neighborhood activities, civic activities, community things, and we hunger for it. So I am really feeling hopeful about a turn that I see all across the country of people in all different generations saying they want more community in their life. And how can we reconfigure our lives to have more time for what really matters? And not everywhere, but for sure, but increasingly more and more people choosing time and community over more stuff. And that's what gives me hope, because really what is going to provide the kind of meaning and purpose that we all want in life, and what's going to help us as climate change gets worse, is not a pair of Varnay sunglasses or, you know, fancy car, but it's having community.
I should tell you that Varnay Sunglasses is one of the sponsors of this podcast. I'm just kidding. I don't even know if they still exist.
Do they still exist?
Listen, it's close enough to my last name, although really not particularly. Like, not really. Like, really, when you break it down, there's like some of the same letters. And there is zero association between, you know, my sort of family history and that company. But I was a child in the 80s. And so people would call me Janet Varnay, just because that was sort of the, you know, this thing that was ubiquitous. And I was like so frustrated by it. I took it very seriously at the time. I was like,
my symbol of materialism.
Oh my gosh. Well, let me just say this really quickly. I'm very glad that you just made a joke about being triggered, because I would love to get your take on this thing that I've been struggling with. And I talked about it sort of loosely on someone else's podcast, who is a little bit more of, how do I want to say this? He's just more relentless and fearless about kind of taking the piss out of people and things. And I sort of worry about that stuff more. But we had this whole conversation where, you know, we ended up going into this riff about the idea of being triggered. And I played along with him, And then I got a letter from someone, and I think maybe I talked about this, maybe even just in an intro, or maybe I just replied to it, but someone sent me a note and said, listen, I really don't appreciate you making fun of this idea of being triggered. You know, for many of us, that's a very real situation, and the sensitivity that's being paid towards certain topics and issues, I think is really important. And I felt, my first response was like, I felt terrible. And then my next response was, you know, I'm a person who has a history of, I always am uncomfortable using the term mental illness, but I think if it opens things up and makes people feel more comfortable about acknowledging what they're going through or have gone through, then by all means, I should get comfortable with it. So I've been, these guys know, very overt about my experiences, particularly as a young person, with some pretty interesting psychological twists and turns that I had as an emotional young woman. So there are things that I would say are triggers for me on some level. But, and I'm just curious of what your take on that is. I for me, when someone says, if I'm listening to, for example, a podcast, This American Life, you know, an NPR type podcast, where they say, well, for this next story, we just want to give you a quick warning that this contains material about panic attacks or material about sexual abuse. You know, if that's a trigger for anyone, we just want to give you the warning, this may not be the right story for you. And for me, Annie, what happens is that using that term is almost worse for me than if I just got to decide it on my own, or if I just got to hear it in the moment as it's unrolling. Because for me, hearing the word trigger makes me think of all of the things that are triggers. Does that make sense? Like, I don't want to think of it that way. And I don't mean to be insensitive for people who really are benefiting from that, but I really struggle with it. And I struggle with it, again, as a person who feels like it could apply. I would rather, if it gets to a place where I start to feel uncomfortable listening to something, I would rather make that decision to turn it off rather than be warned every time there might be something that makes me uncomfortable, because then I sort of look at the world as if I'm looking for triggers. Does that make sense?
Right. And whether you're looking for them or not, the world is full of potential triggers. So my sense about triggers is that what's really important is how we relate to that trigger. And do we allow that trigger to take over ourselves and cloud our ability to respond? I mean, I'm triggered by injustice, and I never want to not be triggered by injustice. We should be triggered by injustice. But I'm also triggered by things that I should probably just get over, that because I'm neurotic or petty or, you know, judgmental. So there's different kinds of triggers. But I find for myself that one of the ways that I can take away the power of the kind of triggers I shouldn't be triggered by is make fun of it and make fun of me and say I'm triggered and have a little self-deprecation. One of the ways to deal with the triggers on the big things like racism and systemic injustice is get involved in doing something about it. Mm-hmm. I'd rather see that kind of action than just being paralyzed by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually a really great way of looking at it, because I think that speaks to my sense of I don't want us to over shelter ourselves. And obviously when you get into something, if it's extremely personal, if something happened to you that was extremely traumatic and extremely personal, of course I want to be sensitive to that. I'm just trying to navigate my fear that, you know, I was listening to one, I think it was an Invisibilia, which is a lovely podcast and sort of an emotionally attuned podcast while still being, you know, very intellectual and kind of science oriented. And someone said, I believe, and I shouldn't be quoted on this, but that it was something about bullies and that there was this sort of note of, by the way, this story involves bullying. And if that triggers anyone, this might not be the story for you. Well, I was bullied and I had some pretty traumatic things happen to me as a young person, but I would rather be forced to feel those feelings and move through them as I empathize with someone else who had that situation than shut myself off to it. And, you know, I guess that's just a personal thing that each person has to figure out for themselves. But because it's become this pervasive term right now in the zeitgeist, I find myself thinking about it a lot, you know?
Yeah, that makes total sense. And granted, there are some people who have had such traumatic experiences that's a different situation. But for most of us, if something triggers us because we don't like it, let's fix it. If bullying triggers us, instead of avoiding any mention of bullying, let's find out how some people have dealt with bullying and start experimenting with new approaches and let's solve it.
Yeah. That actually brings me to wanting to ask you, too, about, you know, for you with what you do and the vast amount of kind of activity and contact that you have with the world and needing to kind of have a thick skin, right? Or steel yourself against adversity or steel yourself against people who say, you know, you don't have the right to have this loud of a voice in this way, which I'm sure you've been told over time, that there's this potential for cynicism or bitterness because the more people put themselves out there in support of a cause and the more controversial a cause, the more they're going to be subjected to that. And so I think the question kind of comes up of how, like, and that's sort of what why I said, how do you feel about where we're headed as a species in terms of even just religion is, there can be this opportunity to be totally defeated and feel cynical about people who don't know yet or have made the determination they don't agree with what you believe in versus feeling optimistic and feeling that push forward and feeling, you know, that passion. Is that something that you've struggled with over the course of your career as you grew into an adult and are the person that you are?
You know, I really haven't struggled with that. I just lean into optimism and hope. And I do it for a couple of reasons. Actually, sometimes I think it might just be chemical, the way my brain is, because the scientific data does not back up being optimistic on a lot of fronts. So I absolutely admit there is an irrationality to it that might just be chemical. And, you know, thank my parents' DNA for that, because it's just really good to have that reservoir of optimism. But there's a couple of other reasons that I do lean towards optimism and hope. One is that there are a lot of people all over the world that want to live in a different way, a way that is more sustainable and more healthy and more fair and more fun. There are a lot of people who don't want to be on this corporate, you know, rat, corporate-dominated, toxic, chemical-laden rat race but want something different in life. And you see people opting out, whether it's downsizing or more volunteering or whatever it is, you see all over the world, people are beginning to chart a different path. But the other reason that I lean towards hope and optimism is it's a choice I made. You know, we can't decide everything that happens in the world, but we can decide to at least a large extent how we choose to relate to that. And CO2 is building up in the atmosphere and toxic chemicals are building up in our bodies and the oceans are dying. There's all this stuff going on. I can decide how I want to relate to that. And so I have made a conscious decision that I'm going to be hopeful and I'm going to be optimistic. And in a way, I think of it as my most personal form of resistance or my most personal act of resistance. These big corporate polluters have taken so much from us, you know, whether it's rivers that we used to swim in or took from me the ability to breastfeed my child without fear because I knew what toxic chemicals I was passing on to her. They've taken so much from us that I just want to draw a line in front of me and say, you can't take my mood. You can't take my joy. You can't take what I feel every single morning when I get up, do my stretch and say, I am going out to fight the good fight for a green and peaceful planet. I'm not going to give it up. Can't have it. So it's chemical, partly it's buoyed by the incredible work people are doing all over the world, and partly it's a actual choice I made. I'm gonna choose hope.
That's fantastic. And I think that's a personal choice on this sort of massive global level that we talk about when you do talk about some of the biggest causes that you are fighting for every day, but also it becomes like such a microcosm solution as well in terms of this one person that you see on a daily basis who, you know, toxic relationships, not just toxic chemicals in our bloodstreams, but also toxic relationships and toxic thoughts, right?
Right.
It's all a part of that. And I think that becomes like this very big kind of philosophical question too, which is what's going on an emotional, personal, one-to-one level that makes people feel unempowered or that makes people feel unmotivated or makes people feel helpless about being the agents of change or, you know, and again, even in as simple as this is this one activity I'm going to do differently from here on out. It's small, but it's going to show me that I'm capable of more. And by extension, that we're all capable of more. And then here's you build on that and you build on that. And then suddenly these huge waves of change are happening. That there is this kind of, you know, what am I looking at in my day to day that kind of brings me down that turns everyone inward and doesn't give us that sense of community and just sort of is like, well, it seems to me like this thing is just going the way it's going and you know, I've got enough to worry about. You know,
People often ask me, isn't it hard to try to save the Indonesian rainforest and stop fossil fuel expansion and protect the oceans? Isn't that hard? I say, yeah, it's hard, but you know what would be harder? Not trying. I mean, that would be intolerable. It is really being involved in campaigns like Greenpeace is running that fuels that hope every day. And so if people are feeling discouraged or feeling like there isn't a way for them to make a difference, first thing to do is plug in with people who are making a difference. You know, join the Greenpeace Volunteer Network, which is on our website, or join any group, that local group, national group, international group. Just get involved. It is the absolute best antidote to that sense that we can't change anything. Another thing, though, is to read history. Look at the women's suffragette movement. Look at the abolitionist movement. Look at the civil rights movement. I mean, our country has a beautiful history of people coming together and changing stuff that at one point seemed unchangeable. And there's no reason we have to stop that legacy right now. We can just keep doing it.
That is fantastic. Let me ask you this. As a teenager, what did you feel passionate about? And it can be as, you know, simple as I just absolutely love eating this for breakfast every morning, or it can be a musician that you were really inspired by, or, you know, from even just the little stuff, you know, that made you feel excited, whether it's something that passed or not. I mean, let's, you know, we were a teenager, like there's plenty of room to feel self-conscious and there's plenty of room to go, I don't know why I was so obsessed with French fries, you know, that I'm going to move past that.
I think I was a little ADD because I was like, oh my God, this is so exciting. No, wait, this over here is so exciting. No, this over here is, I think I was.
What were some of the things like that you were flitting around on?
Well, I'll tell you, I really loved the forest. I was lucky that this high school I went to, middle and high school I went to, forced us to go hiking a lot. I mean, I called it forced when I was 10, and by the time I was in high school, I loved it. We went on multi-day backpacking trips, you know, starting Whoa. With just a couple of days at a time. The final one was about 20-day backpacking trip in the Canyonlands of Utah in the senior year of high school.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that is just a stunning, stunning experience. And
I mean, that is where
about
money at a private school does come in handy.
Yeah. Or what about the week-long field trip to San Francisco to see Broadway plays?
Oh, for God's sake. Yikes.
I recently went to my high school reunion and I took my daughter and she was walking around this campus and she said, "You went here, Mom?"
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. I was like, "Yes, I did, honey." Yeah, I was lucky and privileged and learned so many things.
Oh, go ahead. No, please.
I was just going to say being in nature and, you know, I didn't even know the science to understand why ecologically we need nature to survive and the different sort of neurological benefits of being in nature. I didn't know any of that. I just know it felt good. And, you know, when you're a teenager, you want to do what feels good. And for me, it was just getting out into nature.
Oh, that's so great. Were you a reader? Were you an avid reader? Did you kind of love disappearing into worlds that other people had created in addition to being in your own and being out in the forest?
Well, we all read then because there was nothing else to do. I was explaining to my daughter there was four channels, and if you missed the show, you never had another opportunity to see it again. That was it.
Yeah.
You know, what else are you going to do? There were no screens to look at.
Yeah.
So,
oh, boy.
Yeah, we all read back then.
And did you listen to music? Were you a big, you know, did that speak to you? Because I have friends who, you know, I've said this before on the podcast, but friends who music just didn't really play a role. You know, it was like, oh, I listened to whatever was on. And then, you know, all the way to someone who's like, oh, no, that's the reason that I learned how to play guitar. And that's why I'm in this jazz band now. Or, you know, I started writing poetry because of Joni Mitchell, like that sort of thing. Were there artists that had established themselves that were speaking to you in that kind of way?
There was one band that I was absolutely obsessed with, and with my friends and I traveled around the country, saw over 200 concerts. You can probably guess which one it is. It is
Lionel
the Grateful Dead.
Lionel Richie. No, I'm just kidding.
No, the Grateful Dead. My friends and I traveled. Our parents were very lenient. Traveled all over the country seeing Grateful Dead shows, and I think I loved the music for sure. But I think I also loved the real sense of community. It was having this pack of friends that we literally traveled all over the country going to these shows. I remember in college I took a class that was called Religious Cults in Contemporary American Society, and we were supposed to go spend some time with a cult. And so I said, okay, I'm going on Grateful Dead tour. I'll be back in 2 weeks. So I really did, and I still to this day love the Grateful Dead. It dates me somewhat, but I don't care. They are just so good. So
well,
I still
you know
love
yeah.
to crank them.
That was something that, and by the way, I have peers who were deadheads who came in later or, you know, whose parents took them to shows and then I've met people who are in college now who lament that they, you know, didn't have the experience of really experiencing the band in its completion and all that kind of stuff. And I think that to me is something that, and I've been talking about this a lot lately on the podcast, is this idea of when you're a teenager, feeling like things belong to other people and that they can't also be yours. And for some reason that was, while I embraced the sort of goth, world and felt like, yeah, I'm entitled to this. Like I can have this. I can listen to The Cure and Depeche Mode and suddenly drastically change the way I dress and stuff. For me, The Grateful Dead was something I heard about, anecdotally for such a long time. That it was an other thing, right? It was this other thing that other people did. And for some reason, I would draw these lines, these unintentional, you know, unconscious lines in the sand almost, where it's like, oh, well, I've been hearing about that for so long. Clearly that's not something I was ever meant to do because I've just heard about it. Opposed to going, hey, here's this thing I've been hearing about. Maybe I should check it out. Do you know what I'm saying?
It's so funny how we as human beings just tell ourselves these stories that limit what we can do.
Yeah.
Like, that's a perfect example. And think of all the other stories we tell ourselves. I can't do that because why? There's no reason you can't do that. Or you know, I shouldn't raise my voice here. It's like these self-limiting stories. Humans are just so funny the way we do that. did you ever go to a concert, the Dead concert?
I never went.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And I went to school in Flagstaff, Arizona, where people were constantly talking about Dead shows they'd been to. And then it sort of evolved into Fish shows with that particular group of people in Flagstaff. But that's a real, like, Deadhead town. And again, it's like I moved into this town to go to college, and that was, like, already a thing. And I was like, well, that's already a thing. So, but that's not going to be me. It's just funny.
Oh, yeah, it is funny. It's funny what our minds do to ourselves.
It really is. Boy, is it ever. Listen, Annie, I want to get into this MASH game. I'm very excited to do it with you. I've got these different categories, right, that I'll give you. I'll say, okay, give me an example of three blanks, and then in the end we'll do like a little doodle that will create this sort of eeny, meeny, miny, moe situation in which I will reveal to you 100% guaranteed fictional MASH future. I'm going to start out with three places in the world that you could have a sort of second home, and let's pretend that getting there is not a huge issue. It's not like, oh, I have to get on a, you know, fuel guzzling plane for 14 hours. It's almost like you can magically be transported there. Three places in the world you'd love to have a second home.
Oh, that's a delicious question. All right, you ready?
I'm ready.
Orcas Island. You know that place off Seattle, Orcas Island.
I love it.
Yeah, love it
My
too.
My dad goes there every year.
Oh, he's so lucky. It's incredible. So Orcas Island will take. Manhattan, Upper West Side, please.
Great.
Central Park West, if possible.
Uh-huh.
And around 80th.
Okay.
And Kerala in India, the state of Kerala.
Wonderful. India. Okay, wonderful. Okay, next one. This is one of my favorites. And this actually, this might be interesting for you because I'll be interested on your twist or on your take on it. But I always love three foods that are in this world bad for you on some level. And it could be that it's, you know, made in this way that's unhealthy, or it could just be like, let's face it, pasta every day is maybe not a great idea. But three foods that in this alternate universe have somehow conformed into, like, you can just pluck them right off the tree in your backyard anytime you want, and it's totally full of nutrients and vitamins. Three.
Oh, man,
but
I like, love
you
this
know,
game.
Take advantage of it. Really, really get in there with some doozies that you wouldn't really necessarily want to have every time here because they're not good for you.
All right, the opera cake that my teenage daughter makes me once a year for my birthday, because it's such a pain. She'll only make it once a year. Oh, it's so good with almond flour. So,
oh,
taking
yum,
opera cake.
Great.
Coffee, great. Which I know climate change is going to eventually force us to give up. And tuna fish.
Yep. This is exactly what the game is for, my friend. You are playing it like an ace.
Oh, I'm hungry now.
Okay, let's do three skills that you wake up with tomorrow. This sort of idea, you know, in a perfect world, we spend 10,000 hours becoming a maestro at something. But in this crazy world of ours, this MASH world, tomorrow you wake up and you'll have one of three skills. It can be, you know, speaking all languages, or it could be just being amazing at solving your own technological quandaries, anything like that. That's not really a superpower, but frankly, to me, probably does seem like a superpower because it'll just be something that would take that much time to perfect.
Ah, it's so hard to pick three. I'll pick speaking Spanish.
Great.
Playing the piano.
Great.
And fixing things.
Great. Great, great, great. Okay.
Especially
next category.
Electronics. Imagine if we could fix those things instead of throw them out.
I mean, yes indeed. Okay, now this is a MASH game. This is a very traditional aspect of the MASH game. This is in an alternate universe. It could be just a kind of sexy times person that you sort of get to spend a night with, or it could be the sort of alternate universe companion or something in between. But, you know, it can be a character from book. It can be a cartoon. I don't care. It can be an actor or actress that we all know. No one's saying, like, you know this person for reals. Just crushes, you know, the characters. It could be Paul Newman from, you know, a very specific era. But three people that in this alternate universe would be fun to spend some romantic time with.
Okay, I have my daughter tells me this is awful, but Andy Samberg, that guy is so cute.
That is what the game is for. Absolutely.
He's so cute. Oh
yeah.
A younger Denzel Washington,
great.
And Tim Robbins.
Oh, wonderful.
Wait, but there's nobody there who can sing to me. I missed that. That's right. Andy can sing.
Well, now listen, Tim Robbins did that movie, Bob Roberts, where he was a folk singing Republican.
That's right.
If you want him to serenade you with songs about how hippies are dirty, then you're in great shape.
Those are my three secret crushes.
That's fantastic. Fantastic. Okay, perfect. Okay, next one is in your house that you're in right now, kind of like Harry Potter almost, with the sort of room of necessity or requirement. I really apologize to all of you guys who absolutely love Harry Potter and are cursing me right now that I can't conjure up the name. But this
room
idea
of
the room of requirement, right? Where there's this place in your house that doesn't take up any more space because it's almost like you're going into a different dimension. But it's a room that serves, it could be the most whimsical purpose in the world or the most practical purpose. But three things, like, oh, you didn't know about my greenhouse I can just go into that is, you know, 200 square feet and it has all these beautiful tropical plants. Or it could just be, oh, my nap room where I literally don't go in there unless I am going to fall asleep for 2 hours. Anything like that, where it's a sort of a magical extra room in your house that can be filled, the three types of rooms.
Oh, this is so fun. It's a gym.
Great.
It's a gym with an excellent sound system.
Great.
It's my orchid growing greenhouse.
Yes, indeed.
And it's my dog play yard.
Love
where
it.
Where I keep my dozen dogs that I forgot to tell you about.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Oh, you're really going to need that play yard.
I know. And the poop magically disappears. It's awesome in this room.
Oh, that's a great room. Boy, I want in on that room. I may drop my dogs off. Okay. Next category will be, let's do three. Actually, I like this idea since we just talked about it. Three pets that for some reason are not practical at this time. Now, I want to extend that out to, you would like Snoopy, you know, and when I use the term pet, I use it in quotations because a lot of the time the things I would want as pets are actually just like, oh no, I would just want this to be my best friend. But three animal kind of companions that it could be, you know, oh, in real life, I would want a giraffe, but it's impractical and unkind. Or it could be that you would want a dragon, like a totally fictitious thing. Or like I said, Snoopy, three.
I would love a monkey. I just think we could get along so well if I had a monkey in this house.
Great.
I would love a baby elephant because they're so cute and they're so threatened, and I would keep him or her safe here.
Yes, yes, and yes, yes.
Does Dobby count? Is Dobby a pet?
Yeah, let's put Dobby in there. Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, those eyes. You just want to take care of him and make everything okay again forever, even though he wants to take care of you and make everything okay for you forever. I love
it. Also, when he stood up and said, Dobby has no master, I'm like, yes.
If only we
could all get to that point.
I know. Oh, those like therapeutic, cathartic moments in film. Actually, let's do that. This is one of my favorites. Let's do three movie worlds that you can go into and hang out in wherever you, whenever you want. So you're kind of in a safety bubble. It's not like, you know, suddenly you're going to go into Goodfellas and get shot. This is, we're talking about, it's just for fun and play and joy. But three, and so you're not going in to be a character in a movie. You're going in to just be with those characters or be in that world. Three films.
Gosh, that one's harder. I think I'll take Where the Wild Things Are.
Oh, great. And if you want to expand it out to a book, too, that's also totally acceptable.
All right. Well, that's a good one, Where the Wild Things Are. And The Little Prince.
Great.
And I guess you got to say Harry Potter because...
I mean, why not?
You got it. It's so interesting.
She built a pretty marvelous world, I have to say.
Oh,
fantastic. Yeah. Okay, and then final one is if you could... Now, this is a tough one because it's sort of the... Again, it's like a lot of where we need to get involves the work that we need to get there. But let's just say you could change three things about the world tomorrow. What would they be?
I would have national health care for everybody so that everybody everywhere had safe, available
marvelous
access to health care. I just think that marvelous. Think that would help the world so much. I would get us off fossil fuel. No more fossil fuel. Keep it in the ground. Totally renewable energy.
Great.
And I'd make everybody compost. It's like compost is so simple. It would make the country, the world, it would make it so much better. I'd make everybody compost. It's like people want to know what little thing they can do to make a big difference. Compost.
Well, let me ask you this because I want to, we'll finish this up while I do this kind of review and give you your imaginary future. But when we talk about something like compost, right, that's a great example, again, of something that you can do that's small. Where would you send people who, you know, walk away from listening to this episode going, I would like to do something, and let's say it's compost, where would you like them to go to say, listen, here's the best place you can go to just get yourself set up, figure out, you know, the 101 of everything you need to know and how simple it truly is. Where would you like to refer people?
You know, on composting, it's so easy that there are literally 1,000 websites. I like the kind of composting that use worms, and there's a great website called Worms Eat My Garbage.
Worms
the cool
Eat
thing
My
about
Garbage.
Using worms, they make your garbage go away, and then you get this amazing fertilizer, which makes my tomatoes so abundant.
Oh, this
so
is
worms
quite
eat
wonderful.
WormsEatMyGarbage.org.
WormsEatMyGarbage.org. I love it. Okay, why don't you... let's see. I just have to do this quick little doodle thing that will create the formula for me to do my eeny, meeny, miny, mo. I'm making this sound way more official than it is. So I'm going to start this and you just tell me when to stop and it can be pretty fast. Okay. Ready? I'm starting.
Okay. Stop.
Okay, great. All right, Annie, I want to thank you so much for doing the podcast. It's been such a joy. I can't wait to meet you in person. I have some wonderful results. I say that like I'm a doctor who just did some sort of physical. I'm going to give you your prognosis. It's very positive. It's very, very positive. Okay, first of all, I want to congratulate you
excellent
on the fact that you successfully will have the world composting as of tomorrow. So well done. I hope everyone heard that and everyone's listening because get ready. You're going to start composting. Might as well go to that website now, wormseatmygarbage.org. That's the thing. That's what I'm excited about. That's the one that is the most
because
sort of like, hey, let's just all
tomorrow
do it. Why not?
It's actually
so that's fabulous. I want to congratulate you on your beautiful house in Manhattan's Upper West Side. I believe it's right around 80th. So I'm very impressed. When something goes wrong, it's probably an older house. When something is on the fritz, I want to reassure you, you have the ability to just basically fix anything that goes awry. So tinker to your heart's content because it's always going to turn out to be fixed. And that includes all of the exercise equipment in your beautiful gym. Which also, of course, is the secret room, the hidden room inside your current home in the Bay
Beautiful
Area. I want to congratulate you on your companionship with Dobby, who I bet would have a really good time going into the world of the Little Prince
I'm
with
so
you.
Happy.
I think he would probably find that quite magical. And I think he would also probably enjoy eating unlimited amounts of the opera cake that your daughter makes, because in this world you can have it at the snap of a finger right in front of you. No negative ramifications to anyone's health of any kind. Pretty fabulous. And I'll tell you who else is going to be eating that cake with you. You're going to be feeding him morsels of it right into his beautiful mouth is a younger Denzel Washington. Yeah. And that, Annie, is your MASH future.
I nailed it. That.
Really, really great outcome. Could not ask for more than that. Anywhere else that you would like to send people, Annie, to learn more? If you have not checked out The Story of Stuff, please do so. It will blow your mind. And again, the sort of focus that Annie wants you to walk away with is one of optimism, right? It's not something that you're supposed to expose yourself to and then feel lost about. It's something to celebrate.
Absolutely. And Story of Stuff is a great place for seeing films and getting involved, as is Greenpeace. Greenpeace.org. We have lots of opportunities for people to get involved. I'd love it if people join us, get involved, come
Wonderful.
To some of our meetings.
I got to go get my worm started.
Future, because we can do it, starting with our composting.
Annie, thank you so much again. And guys, I will talk to you next time on the podcast.
Never go back.
As always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.